question is being raised with regard to whether young men who are not married, attending yeshiva, should be spending any time studying legitimate shiurim classes that have been given on the topic of the attitude of the Talmud, or Chazal, the great rabbis, towards sexual issues. Whether they should be at all listening to that. At first glance, one would wonder, well, why not? It's a study of Torah. And to the contrary, it's a good thing that many people don't even want to hear the attitude of Torah and these types of things, because it's a very powerful emotional desire, and they don't want to be restricted too much by what the Torah has to say. And certainly, it's a very important area. There's many areas that the Torah covers. You go through, you have Gemara, you have Talmudic discourses on virtually any subject, and by far, I'd say the overwhelming majority of them really don't have practical application. A person can study many areas, many tractates of the Talmud pertaining to the laws that govern damages with an ox that gores and other types of things, which really are not needed for practical implementation, but it's the study of Torah. One gains illumination just from the study of Torah, per se, even if the area is not practical today. Doesn't matter. It's Torah. Certainly, if the area is practical, and not only in a halachic way, that is, if a person is studying the laws of blessings or Birkat HaMazon or prayer, that's practical, so it illuminates your performance. This has an additional advantage, not just that it's practical, but it's a very significant area in terms of one's moral perfection. So, for all of these reasons, it would seem that it's a very, very important area for a person to study. The only question is, at what point in time? Most people would agree that this would not necessarily be suitable for children, for youngsters, and that a certain degree of maturity would have had to have been achieved before you would introduce this kind of material. The question is being raised with regard to people that are about late teens and are single, are not at the point in life when they're prepared to get married. And the question is being raised whether it's suitable or when perhaps it's unsuitable. And why is it unsuitable? The argument is being raised, or in the form of a question, that it could be negative. And the negative would be with regard to the prohibition of arousing sexual thoughts, fantasies, which is a serious prohibition. It's called hear her. That is, that it's prohibited for men to engage in any type of thing which would arouse erotic thoughts. Whether it be through looking at certain pictures. And in that case, bear in mind that the Torah definition of pornography does not conform necessarily to the society's definition of pornography. And things which in this society might be considered very, very appropriate would, according to our definition, fall under the heading of pornography, even though that's not necessarily a term that we use. I'm just using that term descriptively. You could open up a lot of newspapers or magazines. I mean, what would be considered wholesome magazines, or a copy of the Sunday, New York Times Sunday magazine, and you could find many things that would be regarded as pornographic. Because pornography is not defined by nudity or total nudity. A woman could be posing for a picture, fully clothed, and it could be considered pornographic. The criteria would be the effect that it has on the person who's perceiving it. If it is, and it doesn't really mean, I'm not saying that it's suggestive or it's erotic. It doesn't really matter. That's not the point. The point is if, as a result of looking at it, it rouses or raises thoughts, erotic thoughts, and sexual fantasies in the one who perceives it, so that that makes it prohibited. That makes it, so to speak, pornographic. There's a lot of pictures, and you may even find it when you're riding a bus. It's in advertising, posters, and so forth. Because this is a society that's steeped in the sensual and the sexual. And the sexual permeates every area. Every sport has to have its cheerleaders. And that's a very significant selling point. Virtually any product, any car that you want to sell, has to conjure up this fantasy. That's what they're selling. They're selling a fantasy. They're not selling the car. The car is part of a fantasy. It sounds ridiculous. Then why would a person buy this particular car? Because somebody put up a picture of some handsome young individual with this beautiful blonde or something of that sort, then it has to do with that car. When there's no reality to that. Certainly not for the person who wants to purchase the car. So it would seem that it's absurd, but the fact is that those who invest fortunes of money in advertising happen to know the psyche of people. That the psyche of people does not operate according to logical criteria for many people, enough people to make it worthwhile. Therefore, what we have to encounter is the appearance of pictures or women, that's one form of it, in so-called sexy. Something is sexy. Now, in our society, just because it's sexy doesn't mean it's pornographic. It measures it by other criteria. However, according to the Torah, if it's sexy, that is to say that it has that effect of stimulating fantasies or thoughts, so then it becomes a problem automatically. I'm just trying to show you that we have to approach it from a different standpoint. The same is true, it's not just pictures. It's any kind of media. Magazines, stories. It could be a novel. Any novel which describes erotic situations that would produce hear her, these thoughts, would be in the same category. It's not limited to one particular thing. Thus the question arises, what differentiates this from studying areas of Torah? The Torah goes into all kinds of details about human sexuality. It's a very significant topic. And in doing so, makes reference to all the various organs of the body, or different possibilities in terms of what constitutes sexual relations in forbidden cases and so on and so forth. But there's no question that the Torah and the Talmud gets into virtually every aspect that's pertinent to human sexuality, and thus the question arises, is there a problem in studying those areas? The problem of humor. Basically what's being suggested is that we have to differentiate between fantasizing about something and studying it scientifically. And we can see that in many, many areas. For example, sometimes people are very, very hungry, so they may fantasize about food. Sometimes on a fast day, you're having a tough time, so you start thinking, you start imagining when the fast will be over and feasting and things of that sort. You know, people that are stuck in the desert and are starving begin to fantasize. Now, would you say that that's the same as a serious chef who's trying to think of new possibilities, different types of dishes, and trying to approach it from more of a scientific, so to speak, point of view? Is that the same thing? Are they both engaged in the same activity? Same question can be raised about a doctor. The more you think about it, the more you wonder, how is it possible, or is it possible, for religious Jews to be doctors? Since anatomy is a very significant aspect of medicine, and in general, Not to mention a field like gynecology, where you're specifically dealing with women and that part of their anatomy, which would, generally speaking, be prohibited. But any doctor has to examine the patient. They have to remove the clothing and so on and so forth. Is it a problem? It seems to me that most professionals, I speak to most doctors. Of course, you always have cases of abuse where a doctor will abuse a patient, take advantage, but you'll have that in any field. It's not necessarily because a person is a doctor. It could happen in any field. It's a different part of the psyche. They're not walking around constantly in a state of arousal. It's the contrary. Because it all depends upon the attitude of the psyche towards the phenomenon. The psyche can approach the phenomenon in a attitude of emotionalism and then giving full rein to the lust, and that's the way you relate to it. Or one has the ability to absolutely control it, the lusting part, and to view it from the scientific, from the intellectual standpoint, in which it just becomes another object to investigate intellectually. And when that happens, it's no different than any other subject matter. Thus, if you study those areas of Talmud, the person thinks, the person that's not really that interested in learning, has difficulty, and thinks the subject matter doesn't really interest them. And let's say they would get that thought, but I'm interested in human sexuality. Maybe if I was studying that, I'd have more of an incentive and I'd study harder. You will see after a day or two of learning that there's no difference. It's going to boil down pretty much to the same approach. It's going to be halachic. Because the focus, the concentration is not on the indulgence. It's on the halachic, all the abstract issues. And this happens to relate to that. That's the starting point, and it has to relate to that. But your mind is going to be concentrating on abstract issues. So that's what it's going to engage. If you cannot engage the analytic, intellectual component of the mind, then you're not going to be studying it. And it's not going to present any kind of material which is going to be pleasing to someone who's coming to the subject matter from the standpoint of a desire for any kind of fantasy or sexual lust. It's just not constructed that way. So you will find that there's no difference between studying those areas of Torah which pertain to human sexuality and any other area. You'll have, if a person enjoys learning, you'll have the same enjoyment, the same fulfillment, and sometimes you, after you finish learning something and you're satisfied because you worked it out and the clarity, it produces a certain type of a feeling. You'll have that same feeling of satisfaction, untainted with any type of a feeling of an emotional or a sensual gratification. There's no difference between that subject matter and any other subject matter. And the same would be true when a person is studying medicine. When you're studying medicine, you have to put aside the emotional. That is, there are certain objects that you can relate to from a purely emotional standpoint, the emotional impact that it has upon you, as opposed to looking at it from a purely scientific. Now, let me study the phenomena. What's the phenomena? When you're studying the phenomena, the emotional is not there anymore. This has to be true. Not just in the sexual. Even, for example, if you're going to make a scientific study of Nazism, when you read it, when you first read about Hitler and you see the films, what he did, it fills you with a certain kind of a rage. That's an emotional reaction. I can illustrate this distinction in many areas. I'm going to illustrate it over here. So if, as long as you're filled with that type of a feeling, so how can you study Nazism? You really can't study it. You're not engaging in any kind of study. However, we have the capacity, when you're studying Hitler and you're trying to understand and dissect his mind and what the motivating factors are, then you're not relating to Hitler in the framework of an emotional hatred. You're not. You're putting that aside, and now you just say this is a phenomenon of reality, as though you were studying a grizzly bear that attacked people and you didn't want to know why it attacked. You're putting aside any emotion, and now it's just another aspect of reality, and my objective is to gain understanding. From all of these things we see that there are two ways in which the psyche can relate to certain phenomena. One can relate to it purely from the sensual aspect of the personality, in which case one has to be on guard against what could be here. Now, different kinds of media. You can go to a movie. The movie can be a violent movie, violence. So that you relate to when you go to the movies. Basically, you're going because you want to indulge in a certain type of emotional gratification of certain kinds of fantasies. Now, if it's violence, so you're relating to it purely from the sensual aspect, and it arouses certain types of feelings, certain types of emotions within you. But they don't constitute here. That's not subsumed under the heading of prohibited thoughts or fantasies. So that if a person has a fantasy about inflicting violence on someone, he didn't violate any halacha. Now, I'm not saying that it doesn't indicate he may have a problem. He may have a defect in his personality. It may be something he wants to investigate. But that is not under prohibited thoughts. A person may go to a movie because they want to analyze it. Let's say you're a movie critic. A movie critic looks at a movie from a completely different standpoint. And that's why afterwards, if you have a discussion with a movie critic, you'll see you weren't interested in the structure, in the character development, in certain aspects of the plot. You were just interested in what impact it has on my emotions. The critic is looking at it differently. Thus, we see that the mind can differentiate. Therefore, I say that if a person reaches that degree of maturity where they can differentiate and they have a certain attitude of seriousness which they bring to the subject, that's why for children they're not ready for that type of seriousness and they may not be able to differentiate because certain media or a certain subject matter will just evoke a certain emotion and it may be too powerful for them to deal with it. But it would seem to me that all things being equal, people that we're talking about in their late teens should be able to make that distinction. Then, of course, the question would be, what is the reason for approaching it? The person has to be very honest with themselves. The motivation should be in order to understand. And it doesn't mean you have to wait until you're about to get married. That's not necessarily the case. It's good to have a foundation. And if necessary, to perhaps prepare yourself and gear yourself to be in line with the truths. But if a person has a certain frivolousness, and the reason why they want to be involved in that type of subject matter is because of frivolous reasons, then it would not be a good idea. Then they should wait, and maybe they should discuss it with someone. However, the point that I'm trying to make is this, that there's no way that one should associate legitimate study of Torah where the topic happens to be aspect of sexuality with any problem of hearer. It's Torah. And Torah is always abstract. It's always ideas. It's always conceptual. So you're in the world of conceptual. It doesn't make any difference what it's referring to. Whether it's referring to a particular form of activity on Shabbos, whether it constitutes malacha or not, whether it's dealing with the subject of mourning, avelos, you'll find that that's just a jump-off point, and all of a sudden we're getting into all kinds of abstractions. Your focus, your energy is going to be on the abstractions, otherwise you're not studying Torah. So that's why, I'll give you another example. One of my favorite areas to study is the laws of mourning, the tractate in Moed Katan, which deals with mourning. I think the average individual would say that's a morbid topic. Why do you like to study so much about mourning? I don't even want to study about that because it brings all kinds of morbid thoughts to mind. I've studied it many times, and anyone that studied it with me will know that there's nothing morbid. You're not getting involved in morbid. You're getting involved in all the halachic aspects of it that pertain to it, and it's no different. The reason I enjoy it is because the halachic formulations are very appealing to me. But there's nothing, when you're studying it, you're not involved in the emotional reality of death. Halacha is not involved in the emotional reality of the subject it's dealing with. It's involved in something completely different. So therefore I say that there's no reason why that has to be the case. Interestingly enough, the Rambam says that Hebrew is referred to as Lashon HaKodesh, the holy language, because it does not have any direct terms for the bodily organs or for the sexual act. It's always by euphemism. Now that's an amazing corroboration of what we're saying. That is to say, because certain terms, certain words evoke certain emotional responses. So by merely uttering those words, it's relating you to the phenomena in an instinctual, emotional kind of a way. But by relating to it through euphemism, which is the mind, it's intellectual, it's conceptual, that is a different, has a different effect completely, and that's why it's Lashon HaKodesh. It's the holy language. Thus you see from that, that this point is already incorporated in the very idea of the language itself. In line with this, I want to make an additional point. When I mentioned before that our criteria, our definition of what would constitute so-called pornography is completely different than contemporary society, another example would be movies, which let's assume would be rated G, I think is the most benign, which is suitable for everyone. It might be prohibited. That only means to say that it avoids certain type of language and avoids nudity and things of that sort. But it could be a romantic story with no nudity, what's considered appropriate in general society. But it could be very romantic. It could depict people holding hands and kissing, embracing. As long as it doesn't cross a certain boundary line, it's accepted in our society. But for people watching it, it could have the effect of arousing hearer. And from that standpoint, would have to be considered as a serious problem. Also want to add that Rav Moshe, in a tshuva, a responsa, question was raised by a serious yeshiva student that sometimes when you travel on the trains, it's very crowded. And there are men and women there, and you come into physical contact with women. Because sometimes you're packed in, or you're holding on to a rail, and everybody else's hand is there, and your hand can be touching a woman's hand, and not by any choice, it just happens. And is that prohibited, because you're touching another woman? And as he explained, the prohibition is not touching per se. It is what we refer to as chibuk v'nishuk, the prohibition of hugging and kissing, is only in a sexual context. That is, when it's done as a form of passion, endearment, and so on. And thus, one should not do this. The question arises with regard to shaking hands with a woman. Is it permitted or prohibited? Now, obviously the ideal is to refrain from sexual contact. However, in a business situation, where there's absolutely no arousal, it's a business situation, and it's expected that you shake hands with a woman, and not to do so would be very offensive. It's not prohibited. It doesn't violate the prohibition of so-called contact with a woman, because the contact that's prohibited would be one which has some type of a sensual, sexual aspect. Now, of course, where possible, there has to be a boundary line. So one should avoid physical contact in general, and it shouldn't be going around saying, well, I don't think that this will arouse any kind of thoughts. I'm just saying a person should avoid it in general. What Rabbi Feinstein was talking about was on a train where you have no choice and you're packed together and you touch another woman's hand or whatever it may be, that he's saying that doesn't violate the law. So you didn't do it intentionally, and that type of contact is not a prohibited one. However, he did say if the individual is one in whom this would arouse sexual thoughts, the violation of hearer that we're talking about, then it would be prohibited. And what do you do? Whatever you do. You don't go on that train. You work it out somehow. We're not getting into the practicalities. Then it would be prohibited.